Part 1, 4 questions 1 to 5, listen to a talk about nanotechnology and its applications and complete the form below. You have 20 seconds to look at the questions. You will listen to it twice.
Today's lecture is the first of a series of lectures on nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, sometimes shortened to nanotech, refers to the manipulation of matter on an atomic and molecular level. It's a science, engineering, and technology conducted at the nanoscale, which is about 1 to 100 nanometers. It is the study and application of extremely small things and can be used across all the other science fields. Just how small is that? A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. The idea of nanoscale research first started from a physicist called Richard Feynman in 1959. He envisaged a process in which scientists would be able to manipulate and control individual atoms and molecules. In fact, it wasn't until 1981, with the invention of a special kind of microscope, that modern nanotechnology truly began. Even though nanotechnology has created many new materials and devices with a vast range of applications, there is always concern over these unnatural products. Many people are worried that they may pose a threat to the environment, health and safety, also known as EHS. In order to better understand and evaluate the potential harm, risk assessment has been introduced. There are also ongoing international collaborations on nano-EHS research and related policy issues. Despite the concern, nanotechnology has benefited society in unexpected ways. In the food processing industry, nanotechnology is leveraged against iron deficiency, which triggers anemia. For example, by reducing the particle size in potatoes, this new technology improves the bioavailability of this nutritional ingredient without the tendency to cause color and odor changes. In terms of packaging, nanomaterials are more economical and are used in all sorts of products, chocolate in particular. Nanotechnology can also enhance the flavor of food. On a domestic scale, we expect more smart furniture, which is made of shape memory alloys, to be manufactured.
Now you'll hear the recording again.
Today's lecture is the first of a series of lectures on nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, sometimes shortened to nanotech, refers to the manipulation of matter on an atomic and molecular level. It's a science, engineering and technology conducted at the nanoscale, which is about 1 to 100 nanometers. It is the study and application of extremely small things and can be used across all the other science fields. Just how small is that? A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. The idea of nanoscale research first started from a physicist called Richard Feynman in 1959. He envisaged a process in which scientists would be able to manipulate and control individual atoms and molecules. In fact, it wasn't until 1981, with the invention of a special kind of microscope, that modern nanotechnology truly began. Even though nanotechnology has created many new materials and devices with a vast range of applications, there is always concern over these unnatural products. Many people are worried that they may pose a threat to the environment, health and safety, also known as EHS. In order to better understand and evaluate the potential harm, risk assessment has been introduced. There are also ongoing international collaborations on nano-EHS research and related policy issues. Despite the concern, nanotechnology has benefited society in unexpected ways. In the food processing industry, nanotechnology is leveraged against iron deficiency, which triggers anemia. For example, by reducing the particle size in potatoes, this new technology improves the bioavailability of this nutritional ingredient without the tendency to cause color and odor changes. In terms of packaging, nanomaterials are more economical and are used in all sorts of products, chocolate in particular. Nanotechnology can also enhance the flavor of food. On a domestic scale, we expect more smart furniture, which is made of shape memory alloys, to be manufactured.
Part 2. 4 questions 6 to 10, Listen to a talk about the trip to Arctic Circle and decide whether these statements are true, T, or false, F.
Last year, I found myself flying to the Arctic Circle with five biologists from the Canadian Wildlife Service. As our small plane descended towards a snow-covered runway, I looked out of the window at the frozen ocean below. I could see small holes in the ice and, around them, lots of extraordinary little figures rather like ants. I was told they were seals basking on the ice in the sun. 10 minutes after we'd landed, I had my first sighting of a wolf, which my eagle-eyed colleagues pointed out to me, at least 700 meters away. And later on, I was lucky enough to see a caribou with its huge antlers at much closer range. At first sight, the Arctic seems to be a kind of desert, but there are plants and animals around. You just have to look around for them. You may find what's called an oasis. This is a little confined area with access to water, where vegetation can establish itself and provide nutrients for animals. Arctic plants have evolved to cope with this harsh environment, like the yellow Arctic poppy, which only has a tiny tuft of leaves visible, as the bulk of the plant, a network of roots, stays underground. Its leaves remain green all winter, so it can make the most of the short growing season. The diversity of bird species decreases as you travel north, but there are birds which spend the winter here, and others that come back in the spring. Most of these birds get their nourishment from seeds, although a predator like the snowy owl feeds on small mammals called lemmings, and others do manage to find fish. For accommodation, we had tents which looked just like the igloos the local Inuit people build out of ice, with little tunnels at the front, only ours were orange and made of nylon, and our only connection to the outside world was our radio link. You notice how light the snow cover is. It scatters with the wind, and there are hardly any deep drifts. Apart from the cold, the main hazard is the wildlife, and I received a brief introduction on the correct action to take if a polar bear came to visit. There are other large animals, like the muskox, but they seldom pose a threat. Another thing was that recording the team's descriptions of wildlife, which was my task, was incredibly difficult. The recorder itself was fine, but batteries just don't work in the cold, so I had to hold them inside my thick coat to keep them warm. But on the whole, I found it a fairly amazing...
Now you'll hear the recording again.
Last year, I found myself flying to the Arctic Circle with five biologists from the Canadian Wildlife Service. As our small plane descended towards a snow-covered runway, I looked out of the window at the frozen ocean below. I could see small holes in the ice, and around them, lots of extraordinary little figures rather like ants. I was told they were seals basking on the ice in the sun. 10 minutes after we'd landed, I had my first sighting of a wolf, which my eagle-eyed colleagues pointed out to me, at least 700 meters away. And later on, I was lucky enough to see a caribou with its huge antlers at much closer range. At first sight, the Arctic seems to be a kind of desert, but there are plants and animals around. You just have to look around for them. You may find what's called an oasis. This is a little confined area with access to water, where vegetation can establish itself and provide nutrients for animals. Arctic plants have evolved to cope with this harsh environment, like the yellow Arctic poppy, which only has a tiny tuft of leaves visible, as the bulk of the plant, a network of roots, stays underground. Its leaves remain green all winter, so it can make the most of the short growing season. The diversity of bird species decreases as you travel north, but there are birds which spend the winter here, and others that come back in the spring. Most of these birds get their nourishment from seeds, although a predator like the snowy owl feeds on small mammals called lemmings, and others do manage to find fish. For accommodation, we had tents which looked just like the igloos the local Inuit people build out of ice, with little tunnels at the front, only ours were orange and made of nylon, and our only connection to the outside world was our radio link. You notice how light the snow cover is. It scatters with the wind, and there are hardly any deep drifts. Apart from the cold, the main hazard is the wildlife, and I received a brief introduction on the correct action to take if a polar bear came to visit. There are other large animals, like the muskox, but they seldom pose a threat. Another thing was that recording the team's descriptions of wildlife, which was my task, was incredibly difficult. The recorder itself was fine, but batteries just don't work in the cold, so I had to hold them inside my thick coat to keep them warm. But on the whole, I found it a fairly amazing...
Part 3. You'll hear a radio interview with the gardening experts Jed and Helena Stone. Choose the answer, A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear.
Jed Stone's best known now for his talents as a garden designer, but he and his wife Helena ran a highly successful jewelry business in the 1990s, which brought them fame and high living. Then they lost it all, and some years later bought a derelict house, which they renovated, and now together they've created a garden. They join me in the studio today. You do seem to do most things in partnership, like the jewelry business, but using Jed's name. Why is that? Helena?
Well, this is a bit of a bone of contention, actually. We have a friend in PR who said, "You have a great name, Jed Stone. People would pay a fortune for such a good name." But sadly, at the time, it never crossed my mind that I wouldn't get the credit for what we do. And that does get to me sometimes. But there again, I'm very bad at putting myself forward. People see Jed as a figurehead, which is fine, actually, because I don't enjoy being recognised or get any thrill out of that, whereas Jed loves it.
Is that right, Jed?
Obviously, I'd love to say no, I don't, but yeah, I do. Even as a child, I thought it must be marvellous to walk down a street and have people know who you were. Ironically, that's the worst of it now. It would be nice just to go and buy a paper without somebody saying something, but I suppose I do like being a public figure. Gives me a sense that I've done something people appreciate. Doesn't stop me doing anything, but it does modify how I do it.
But Helena, you did appear on our television screens briefly as a presenter on the travel show. That must have been a dream job, travelling around the world.
Actually, I thought I was being heroic taking that job. I'd actually rather have gone down a coal mine. It was ironic, really, because Jed adores travelling, whilst I hate it. The timing was critical, though. I mean, we were living in this derelict house. We'd knocked huge holes in the walls to make windows, and we could hardly afford to get the job finished. And I wanted to be there when it was done. So I genuinely didn't want to do the job they were offering, but I felt I had no choice because, apart from anything else, it would provide us with a reasonable income.
So what about this jewel garden? Did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do when you bought the house?
Not at all. In fact, we were provoked into action. I was giving a lecture on gardening, and I was including some snaps of our own wilderness to show what certain plants looked like. But these photos hadn't loaded onto my laptop properly, and you couldn't see a thing. So I started to make it all up, describing this jewel garden with magical colours. It came straight out of my imagination. Hadn't been a long-term plan or anything. Anyway, as soon as I'd finished, these journalists came rushing up saying, "We must come and take pictures of your jewel garden." And I heard myself replying, "Fine, but come when the colours are good. Don't come now." To cut a long story short, we had to make the jewel garden before they came. And actually, we did 90% of the work that summer. That was our incentive.
And why did you call it a jewel garden? Having read about the disasters with the jewellery business, one would have thought you wouldn't want the word jewel in your house at all.
Well, I like to work on projects. And if you have a project where you're thinking only of jewel colours, then that starts to limit you. And design is all about reduction. Really, it was just a good, positive way of tackling what plants we were putting in and the way we were going to design the garden, wasn't it, Jed?
Yeah, but for me, it was also partly a metaphor. It's making something worthwhile out of a failure. We did spend years doing the jewellery, and it wasn't all disastrous. There were good things about it too, and we wanted to salvage them and treasure them. Seemed a waste not to take that bit of our lives and to somehow incorporate it into our new design venture, to take the bad experience and use it in a creative way.
Jed and Helena, thank you for telling us about it today.
Now you'll hear the recording again.
Jed Stone's best known now for his talents as a garden designer, but he and his wife Helena ran a highly successful jewelry business in the 1990s, which brought them fame and high living. Then they lost it all, and some years later bought a derelict house, which they renovated, and now together they've created a garden. They join me in the studio today. You do seem to do most things in partnership, like the jewelry business, but using Jed's name. Why is that? Helena?
Well, this is a bit of a bone of contention, actually. We have a friend in PR who said, "You have a great name, Jed Stone. People would pay a fortune for such a good name." But sadly, at the time, it never crossed my mind that I wouldn't get the credit for what we do. And that does get to me sometimes. But there again, I'm very bad at putting myself forward. People see Jed as a figurehead, which is fine, actually, because I don't enjoy being recognised or get any thrill out of that, whereas Jed loves it.
Is that right, Jed?
Obviously, I'd love to say no, I don't, but yeah, I do. Even as a child, I thought it must be marvellous to walk down a street and have people know who you were. Ironically, that's the worst of it now. It would be nice just to go and buy a paper without somebody saying something, but I suppose I do like being a public figure. Gives me a sense that I've done something people appreciate. Doesn't stop me doing anything, but it does modify how I do it.
But Helena, you did appear on our television screens briefly as a presenter on the travel show. That must have been a dream job, travelling around the world.
Actually, I thought I was being heroic taking that job. I'd actually rather have gone down a coal mine. It was ironic, really, because Jed adores travelling, whilst I hate it. The timing was critical, though. I mean, we were living in this derelict house. We'd knocked huge holes in the walls to make windows, and we could hardly afford to get the job finished. And I wanted to be there when it was done. So I genuinely didn't want to do the job they were offering, but I felt I had no choice because, apart from anything else, it would provide us with a reasonable income.
So what about this jewel garden? Did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do when you bought the house?
Not at all. In fact, we were provoked into action. I was giving a lecture on gardening, and I was including some snaps of our own wilderness to show what certain plants looked like. But these photos hadn't loaded onto my laptop properly, and you couldn't see a thing. So I started to make it all up, describing this jewel garden with magical colours. It came straight out of my imagination. Hadn't been a long-term plan or anything. Anyway, as soon as I'd finished, these journalists came rushing up saying, "We must come and take pictures of your jewel garden." And I heard myself replying, "Fine, but come when the colours are good. Don't come now." To cut a long story short, we had to make the jewel garden before they came. And actually, we did 90% of the work that summer. That was our incentive.
And why did you call it a jewel garden? Having read about the disasters with the jewellery business, one would have thought you wouldn't want the word jewel in your house at all.
Well, I like to work on projects. And if you have a project where you're thinking only of jewel colours, then that starts to limit you. And design is all about reduction. Really, it was just a good, positive way of tackling what plants we were putting in and the way we were going to design the garden, wasn't it, Jed?
Yeah, but for me, it was also partly a metaphor. It's making something worthwhile out of a failure. We did spend years doing the jewellery, and it wasn't all disastrous. There were good things about it too, and we wanted to salvage them and treasure them. Seemed a waste not to take that bit of our lives and to somehow incorporate it into our new design venture, to take the bad experience and use it in a creative way.
Jed and Helena, thank you for telling us about it today.
Part 4. Four questions from 16 to 25. You will hear someone called Karen Williams talking about her career. And complete the notes below.
Complete the sentences with a word or short phrase.
I left school with an ambition to work in hotels as a manager in England or maybe abroad. My local college offered a 2-year diploma in hotel administration and tourism. The course involved 3 periods of work experience, as well as modules covering hotel front office, restaurant, housekeeping, business studies, and languages. My first work experience was in the housekeeping department of a hotel. It was hard work and I was only there for 2 weeks. I learned all about cleaning rooms, what equipment to use, changing beds and, more importantly, about life in a hotel. For the last 2 days, I worked with a floor housekeeper, planning rotas and checking rooms. The second placement was for 4 months. I went to work in Germany. Although I had studied the language at college, my language skills improved dramatically. Most of the time I worked in the restaurant and housekeeping. The final work experience of 5 weeks was in the front office of a hotel, where I learnt all about the switchboard, reservations, porter's desk and cashiers. I decided to carry on studying and do a higher national diploma, or HND, in hospitality management. During the summer months between one course and another, I worked in a restaurant kitchen. I'd never worked in a kitchen before, and it was interesting to see how one worked. Although I decided that I didn't want to be a chef, the experience of seeing what goes on was invaluable. The two-year HND was very interesting. Some students had come straight from school, some from hotel and catering courses, and some had got into the course as a result of their age and experience. We studied a range of subjects, including business studies, hotel management, human resource management, and operational techniques. There were also some optional subjects, and I took conference and leisure facility management, advanced business, and languages. The work experience was very useful, and I had to write a detailed report on green issues in hotels. That was probably the thing I found most difficult on the course, although it certainly gave me a different perspective on things. It was interesting. For example, I reviewed giveaways, such as soaps and shampoos, as part of the report. I became a student member of the HCIMA, the Hotel and Catering International Management Association, when I started the course, and I was able to request information from them. Their magazines often have articles of interest that students can use for assignments. My other source of information was Caterer and Hotel Keeper, the weekly magazine. The college was associated with the university, and so after I completed the HND, I was able to go straight on to the third year of a degree in hotel and restaurant management. I completed that course fairly recently, and I've just started work as a junior assistant manager at a London hotel. I love the work there, although sometimes the duty management shifts are a bit of a killer. Usually, the hotel is overbooked when I'm on duty, and so I often end up as the one who has to book out guests. We use a nearby hotel of the same standard and provide transport, but it is understandable when a guest gets very irate, arriving after a long journey. My aim is to stay here to gain experience before I move on. Possibilities include hotels within the group or maybe abroad, where I can use my languages. One day, I'd like to be a general manager. I left school with an ambition to work in hotels as a manager in England or maybe abroad. My local college offered a 2-year diploma in hotel administration and tourism. The course involved 3 periods of work experience, as well as modules covering hotel front office, restaurant, housekeeping, business studies, and languages. My first work experience was in the housekeeping department of a hotel. It was hard work and I was only there for 2 weeks. I learned all about cleaning rooms, what equipment to use, changing beds and, more importantly, about life in a hotel. For the last 2 days, I worked with a floor housekeeper, planning rotas and checking rooms. The second placement was for 4 months. I went to work in Germany. Although I had studied the language at college, my language skills improved dramatically. Most of the time I worked in the restaurant and housekeeping. The final work experience of 5 weeks was in the front office of a hotel, where I learnt all about the switchboard, reservations, porter's desk and cashiers. I decided to carry on studying and do a higher national diploma, or HND, in hospitality management. During the summer months between one course and another, I worked in a restaurant kitchen. I'd never worked in a kitchen before, and it was interesting to see how one worked. Although I decided that I didn't want to be a chef, the experience of seeing what goes on was invaluable. The 2-year HND was very interesting. Some students had come straight from school, some from hotel and catering courses, and some had got into the course as a result of their age and experience. We studied a range of subjects, including business studies, hotel management, human resource management, and operational techniques. There were also some optional subjects, and I took conference and leisure facility management, advanced business, and languages. The work experience was very useful, and I had to write a detailed report on green issues in hotels. That was probably the thing I found most difficult on the course, although it certainly gave me a different perspective on things. It was interesting. For example, I reviewed giveaways, such as soaps and shampoos, as part of the report. I became a student member of the HCIMA, the Hotel and Catering International Management Association, when I started the course, and I was able to request information from them. Their magazines often have articles of interest that students can use for assignments. My other source of information was Caterer and Hotel Keeper, the weekly magazine. The college was associated with the university, and so after I completed the HND, I was able to go straight on to the third year of a degree in hotel and restaurant management. I completed that course fairly recently, and I've just started work as a junior assistant manager at a London hotel. I love the work there, although sometimes the duty management shifts are a bit of a killer. Usually, the hotel is overbooked when I'm on duty, and so I often end up as the one who has to book out guests. We use a nearby hotel of the same standard and provide transport, but it is understandable when a guest gets very irate, arriving after a long journey. My aim is to stay here to gain experience before I move on. Possibilities include hotels within the group or maybe abroad, where I can use my languages. One day, I'd like to be a general manager.
That's the end of the test.